Thanks very much to Paul for the invitation. Clovio's been a long time. And thank you all for coming out this evening. It's a fantastic venue. It's a wonderful event. It's a wonderful phenomenon, really, Clovio. And very privileged to be here. So, reading from their most recent collection. I'm sure you've all seen glass blowing at some stage. My opening poem is inspired by watching someone blowing glass, and it got me thinking about how it resembled poetry in some ways, actually how it just resembles life, really. So. Crystal. The blower adds breath to heat, turns and blows within the mould until he finds precise form. Molten glass vibrates. It takes 10 years to learn how deep you can cut before the glass shatters. How deep you have to go to catch the light. Mistakes pile up, waiting for the furnace, a second chance. Instability anchored by the weight of lead. It's the amazing thing about crystals, it's the lead that makes it sparkle. Some years ago, I was on a holiday down in southern Spain, in Huelva's down in the southwest, and we were driving through the hills, and we came across open cast mines, which I've never seen before. It's called Rio Tinto, and it's a kind of otherworldly landscape. It's like another planet. Strangely, these huge craters in the ground in a place that's been mined for hundreds and hundreds of years. And as if to just bring that home, the place we parked at the side of the road, we got out of the car, we realised we were actually beside a Roman graveyard, which seemed really uncanny. Rio Tinto. We cannot enter the Roman graveyard. The gates are padlocked and chained, so we press our faces to the wire, squint at the skewed angles of mossed stones, the departed minions of enterprise and empire. Behind us, the mines, where pulleys and sidings punctuate strata of centuries-old endeavor. Rock and mineral are bared in russets and ochres, too raw for peopled places. Their cratered wounds fill with water so deep you could drown there. Today is Sunday. In the high, hushed absence of trucks to rumble up the hill, we try to hear beneath the wind, listen for the sound of stone, touch the injured past, its fissured heat. I grew up in Belfast in the bad times, pretty much, and something peculiar has been happening over the last few years. I don't know how much people not from the north are aware of it, but there have been a lot of very interesting documentaries and books written about events of the 1970s in particular, collusion, all sorts of very dark issues. And light is still beginning to be cast in some of those darker areas. The strange thing is that having been there in the 70s and being aware of some things and not aware of other things, I find myself incredibly moved by this information coming to light. More moved by the things I didn't know about than about the things I did know about. I can't say I really understand that yet, but it pushed me to write pretty explicitly about that period in the north. So there's a section in the book that goes back there, particularly to Mid Ulster. And that line at the end of Rio Tinto, which was written a few years before, the injured past, that phrase becomes the title of the section of the book. The first poem from that section is called Dogged. The injured past comes back like a mangy dog. It hangs around, infecting my doorstep with its sores and the smell of neglect. Trips me up when I venture out, circling my legs, ready for the next casual kick. If I feed it, it'll never go away. If I ignore it, it'll never leave. But press its scabby skin against the door pane, crouch in the corner of my eye, licking its paw, or cower in the wing mirror as I drive away and limp out to meet me when I come back, loyal and unwelcome as disease. I read another couple from this section. The dark topography. There is a country known only to the bereaved of that time, a place not seen through the car windows of passers-by who know nothing of genealogies of pain, the dual burden of trying to find out or trying to forget the truth. They see only green fields, hedges, villages and farms, don't know the ruined cottage was abandoned after a shooting, the new bricks in the corner of a bar were added after a bomb, the tarmac beneath their wheels poured over bloodstains, the too many headstones in the cemetery are carved with the same dates. And I suppose this one is me grappling a bit with, you know, how, well, the whole section was, I grappled with how do you write about this stuff? How do you write about other people's pain? The other questions for a writer, you know, is what language do you use? So actually I have a couple of poems, and I might read them both actually. Yeah. Uncovered. Facts, like sunlight, reveal the smeared surface of memory's lens, the dust and detritus of those awkward corners where we keep the things we didn't want to know. Other people and their pain crowd those corners of my comfortable house. Demanding to be noticed, they look me in the eye and ask, now what? And what am I to say? Finding only words that take me in circles with no clear exit from a prefix that binds us all to the past. Remorse, repentance, revelation, remembrance, recognition, remission, redress, retrieval, reparation, reconciliation, restitution, restoration. Let the facts speak for themselves, perhaps. Desert the lyric's quest for closure, the tyranny of the time of the tidy final line. The crossing. The word is a tug that trawls the first line across the river and hooks it to the other side. We follow, haul ourselves hand over fraught currents, dangle perilously over submerged rocks, tangles of weed. Vowel over vowel, we move slowly, taking the pain, taking pains not to lose a grip of the line, though it chafes our palms, though arm and shoulder muscles strain enough to make the crossing a struggle, enough to make lungs burn and speech shatter, grunting as we inch forwards, suspended in an inarticulate now. Behind us, the words we have left on the shore like ominous clothes. Before us, the heave to the other side. Terra firma, the hope of a new tongue, the anchored tug and its cargo. One of the things it was strange, you know, looking back on the 70s, now that I'm a parent of teenage boys, I did think, God, what must mothers have lived through at that time? I don't have brothers, so while it was dangerous for teenage girls to be out about in the 70s and 80s, it was not as dangerous as teenage boys being out more likely to become political victims. So this is a poem of me imagining what it might have been like for a parent at that time. The watched phone. Her son is out there somewhere. The rain beats his jacket, seeps through his jeans. Runnels of water travel from nape to chin. Somewhere out there, her son in seeping jacket beaten from nape to chin, travels through runnels of water. Out there, the rain seeps nape to chin. Water runnels down jeans and jacket. Her beaten son is travelling. He seeps through jeans and jacket, runneling out somewhere. Rain beats, water seeps, and her son travels, rain runneled, nape to chin, beaten out. Things have changed, thankfully. and a couple of poems now to do with adolescence. One, the first one, Aquarium, to do with my eldest son entering into kind of adolescence. I wrote that a few years ago. and the second one is about me when I was 14. So the first one, Aquarium. I knew you were there long before I saw the blue line. Felt a flutter of seahorse tendrils against deep red coral inside. But a year ago, you dived out of sight. Hormonal weights tied to your feet into unfathomable adolescence. Today, we drift through dimly lit tunnels of submarine dreams, captivated by pulsing coral towers, darting neon tetra, rippling anemones. For a moment, you re-emerge, breaking the surface of monosyllabic self, saying, look, it's the tree of life, and offer me an arm to link. Isn't it amazing how memories can ambush you sometimes? A few years ago, just when I wrote this poem, we were driving somewhere in the dark, and it was something to do with that experience. I was in the back of the car. We were in the dark, people were on the motorway, going to Dublin or something. So it was just dark, some lights outside. And I hadn't realised that our sons had got on to Carlos Santana. And I hadn't heard Santana for absolutely years. But they had a Santana CD, or it was on somebody's iPod. So suddenly there we are, driving in the dark, listening to Samba Pati, which I hadn't heard forever. Like that, I was transported. I was 14 again. I was at a teenage disco with the first love of my life. So this is the poem I came out with. Moving like anemones, Belfast, 1975. I cannot recall if you met me off the school bus, but it was winter and dark in the botanic gardens as we walked hand in hand to the museum. Too young for the pub, in a city of few neutral spaces, this was safe, at least, and warm. The stuffed wolfhound and polar bear were no strangers, nor the small turtles that swam across the shallow pool where we tossed pennies that shattered our reflected faces. We took the stairs to see the mummy, but I saw nothing, nothing at all, alive only to the touch of your fingers seeking mine, moving like anemones in the blind depths. Second section. Disco lights wheeled overhead, we moved in the dark. Samba Pati, a birthday request. The song that the guitar sang, Pa Mi, Pa Ti, and the world melted away. The boys who stormed school buses, the head nuns raised eyebrow. Neither ignorant nor wise, we had no time to figure out which caused more offence, our religions or the 4-year gap between us. I was dizzy with high altitude drowning, that mixture of ether and salt, 14. And out of my death. Section 3. The day was still hot when we stepped into cool velvet-draped darkness. I wore a skirt of my sister's from the year before that swung inches above cork-wedged sandals. You were all cheesecloth and love beads. I closed my eyes and surrendered to the weight of your arm on my shoulders, The tentative brush of your fingers that tingled on my arm, already flushed by early summer sun. Outside the cinema, I squinted, strained to adjust to the light, while you stretched your long limbs like a cat. You were ripe for love and knew it. I blushed and feared its burning touch. My good friend and wonderful Galway poet Sarah Clancy, who I believe is coming here in November for the or October for the Jazz Festival. She's a great poem in her first collection called, you know, Why I Will Never Write a Poem About Greek Mythology. Or I Will Never Write a Poem About Greek Mythology. And until recently I felt like that myself. But I think it was something to do with trying to write about big public themes, conflict of betrayal and things like that, that I found myself kind of visited by a particular Greek myth, and it's the story of Iphigenia, Agamemnon's eldest daughter. And I suppose the way I tend to introduce this story for people who don't know it is it's the bit that Homer left out of the Iliad because it's not very heroic. The Greek fleet have gathered in Aulis, ready to set sail for Troy, but there is no wind because Artemis bears a grudge against Agamemnon. And the priest Calchas consults the oracle and is told that if Agamemnon wants wind for the campaign, good winds, he will have to sacrifice his eldest daughter, Iphigenia. And he does. And that is the basis of the whole heroic story of the Iliad and the Trojan Wars. So I think it's a fascinating story with many, many layers to it. So I wrote a series of monologues, the Aulis monologues, about the sacrifice of Iphigenia, and I'll read a couple of them now. They're told in the perspectives of different witnesses, and the first one is a foot soldier. Blame is a coin passed down from hand to hand. It starts off hidden in the fists of powerful men, but like most things they want to be rid of, it finds its way down to the likes of us. I'll give you an example. Helen takes off with Paris. Good riddance, I've heard some say, but her husband, a powerful man, gathers the lords and all their ships, all prepared for war, when out of nowhere an eerie stillness descends. We wait, temperatures rise, supplies run down, we wait some more, the men wager and squabble. Nature won't comply, so Agamemnon sends Calchas to go find out the gods' true intentions. The priest comes back with sly and sinister counsel. Artemis bears a stubborn grudge, he says, there'll be no wind till Agamemnon pays a price for his own kin. I'll grant you, it's not a choice a man would ask to face. But it was clear to all of us which way it would go. Agamemnon was already itching to get out of all this. In his own mind, he'd waved to his family on the quayside. He was miles out at sea and sailing for Troy. Next thing we hear is the officer's sour muttering. Years of loyal service, no thanks, bad-mouthed on the eve of a campaign, while Calchas drip-feeds hints in high places. The men couldn't be trusted. The anger meant for Troy could climax too soon. All that frustration spurting out prematurely. Who knows? They could even harm their own people. As if we couldn't tell friend from foe. In the end, it wasn't us who harmed our own, but Agamemnon. He had to pass on the blame, of course. Couldn't shoulder it alone. So the coin passed down, hand to hand. It was tarnished by the time it came to us, the knife could file. It always is. It turned our fingers black. This is Agamemnon talking to Euripides, as he feels Euripides has shortchanged him and he characterized him very unfavorably in his play. Right. So, Agamemnon. Magic or moral high ground? Time you made your mind up, playwright. You want to keep the crowd happy and still make them think for themselves? So you knock them out with your gimmicky goddess and expect them to go home debating the deeper moral lesson of the tale. You dress me up as the villain of the piece who'd slay his own child for blind ambition. Not so blind. I've seen more blood than I'd like. But try as you might with your weasel words to make the public hate me, they understand better than you do what it is that I have to do. They know what happens to a conquered people, and they don't want it for their own. So Calchas comes up with a perfect plan that lets them off the hook. I let my child die, so they don't have to. Child killer? Yes. I killed Clytemnestra's first son, too. The people know that, and still they play along. Wave me off to war from the harbour wall. Me and every other soldier Greece will spew out on seas, on plains, and onto the pages of plays. Anything to keep the barbarian at bay. The migrant crisis, but it strikes me as slightly prophetic. Okay, we were talking earlier briefly about how nature can provide a great balance, you know, especially when public events are very dark and can get us down. So this is a poetry festival in Colombia a few years ago. Colombia is an incredibly beautiful country. It just blew my mind completely. So I wrote this short poem, Santa Fe de Antioquia. In the woods there are butterflies bigger than birds. Their white and yellow wing flap slow and silent above the sun-spattered forest floor. In old patios there are birds smaller than butterflies. Glints of emerald suspended in a halo of wing whir. Their syringe beaks sip and sip again, take so little, demand so little of the world. I'm going to finish up with a poem that has, and the title comes from Wordsworth. And Wordsworth's The Prelude. And the title is The Very World. I'll just read the few lines it comes from. Not in utopia, subterranean fields, or some secreted island, heaven knows where, but in the very world, which is the world of all of us, the place where in the end we find our happiness, or not at all. I wrote the poem after watching a documentary about Ahmed Kathrada, who was a friend and ANC colleague of Nelson Mandela's, and who spent a long time on Robben Island as well. And it was, the documentary was fascinating, it was very moving. What was fascinating, I find, was the things he talked about and the things he didn't talk about. The very world. Ahmed Kathrada never told if he got sick on the boat to Robben Island, or if he'd found his sea legs by the time he left, 18 years later. He spoke about the absence of children, the need for a child's voice, so acute there were days his eyes stung with the ache to hear a baby cry. When finally a little girl climbed into his lap, he could not speak, but closed his eyes as the wave of lost years broke over him and he fought for breath. Her spindly arms around his neck, a life buoy, and a noose of trust. Thank you very much.